This is Tales of Northern Michigan's Past with Christopher Struble, and this is part two of his conversation with Mark and Sue Bevins and the Thunder Bay Inn.
Well, it's usually considered Ford Country, right? I mean, Henry had so much property up there and facilities. And
going back to your question earlier, I always thought Henry Ford built this place. I mean, I didn't look that deep, eh?
Yeah, but he comes in around 43. You said just during World War II.
Yeah. Yes, sir. And I got to tell you about Henry. Henry Ford started the $5 workday.
Yep.
And part of that was because he needed employees and he needed to market. But he was smart enough to see that if he doubled the current daily pay rate, that he could create all this energy. And there's this notion that he believed that the middle class could have a sustainable living wage. And so, you know, that actually created post-industrial steam engine era, a middle class. And of course, it's all documented. Everybody in the country came here. But when Henry, what the interesting point is, when Henry's cousin married Mr. God, I got to think of his name.
You got time.
Next to Iron Mountain, Kingsford. Sorry about that.
Oh, Kingsford. When Henry's
cousin. When Henry's cousin married Mr. Kingsford, that created the gateway for Henry to come up and get the natural resources he needed. He needed lumber, 250 board feet per vehicle, and he needed iron ore, and he had to learn how to smelt it and make iron himself. That's the whole River Rouge complex. Anyhow, when he got here, he was so enamored with the working culture that preceded him for 150 to 300 years of logging and mining that it validated his notion that the working class could succeed. And I mean, everybody that came to the UP back in those days came here to work hard,
yeah.
And that's what they did. So when Henry got here, again, he was so enamored, he started building facilities. And he had five of them, and they called them Ford Motor Company Northern Michigan Operations. And by 43, at the age of 81, he had come to Big Bay. Of course, he had a place in the Huron Mountain Club since 29, and that's another story.
That's a whole story.
But he came to Big Bay. And he sunk the equivalent of $130 million of today's dollars.
That's what it said online. It's like $130 million dollars.
Of today's.
Yeah.
It was actually $8 million. A million here, real dollars back then, but $130 of today's dollars in converting the company store into an inn and the Brunswick Mill into a power plant.
Yeah, you build a big power plant, right?
Yeah, it was big wood chips that would fire boilers and that would run big steam engines and big giant generators, one of which is in the Henry Ford Museum, Greenfield Village.
Okay.
And, you know, unfortunately, when Henry passed, the deuce came up and they shut all the operations down. They had been bleeding money for years, but sentimentally, Henry felt compelled to keep employing people up here. But technology was such that they didn't need the lumber and they didn't need the steel from up here.
So the whole facility kind of became antiquated up there. It was kind of obsolete.
Yeah, and you see that in many industries, especially in automotive right now. And as we go to electric vehicles, less and less powertrain will be required, and you'll see a big attrition there as well. But when Henry got here, he was so enamored, he created the town, and I guess I already talked about that. What I was going to tell you was the deuce came up when he shut all operations down. This was post-World War II now, 1953. He was cutting all the steel out of the big power plant over there, and they inadvertently burnt down the Brunswick Mill, which was renovated by Henry Ford. And So that's the end of that. I mean, the mill is still there, the exterior, and it's like a fortress.
Now, is that the building that your son owns that you can see from the top of the hill there?
Yeah, Joshua owns it now, and he's working on some historical preservation grants, and he's not sure what he wants to do, but he definitely wants to preserve it. And it's become quite a monument, that smokestack. It's 290 feet high.
Yeah, that's what defines the town, kind of.
It really does. And, you know, going back to one of the original questions, when I was 10 years old in 1966 and camping at Perkins Park, we snuck over there and we climbed that thing.
Oh, my God. I'm not a heights guy.
I had an Instamatic 110 camera, and I took pictures, and I recall going back to camp and telling everybody I climbed it, and they all thought I was full of it. And when we got home, I couldn't wait to develop that film just to show everybody, which I did, and got the last lap. But haven't climbed it since and don't intend to. I'm a little afraid of heights now.
Yeah, me too.
So
there was a big fire there, though, huh? That facility, a majority of the interior is gone?
Well, the front of the house was developed as a living quarters by the Flurries, Emmy and Linda. And the rest of the building, yes, it was gutted in 53, and it remains that way. So it's structural. It's intact. But really, originally, it was a factory floor with boilers and big power and free conveyors, et cetera, et cetera. So it was sparse even when it was running as a power plant, you know.
Mm-hmm. Now Ford dies in 47, so he acquired it in 43.
Yes.
And by 47, so the hotel wasn't really finished to his specs. By the time he passed away, I think he died at the River Rouge plant, if I'm not mistaken.
He did. And I think what happened was, and I can't validate this, what I'm about to recite, Henry Ford, at the end of his life, converted this company store into an inn at the request of his wife, Claire Bryant Ford, so they could entertain through their nonprofit Henry Ford Hospital chain.
Yep.
So initially she's entertaining and rewarding people from the medical complex. And we did read an excerpt from a fellow that said the Ford executives started hearing what a good time they were having. And I don't want to use the word, well, I'll just say it, butt hurt. So I think there was some excursions there. And, you know, there's something that I got to tell you, and I have never had a vocation for history, and I feel like something's possessing me to dive into just this local area. I'm not astute about the Civil War, about Napoleon, about this, that, or the next thing, but as it relates to cultivating the history here, I'm really, really inspired. Never knew that, but I am. And if we come across other information, in other words, I'm explaining to you what we know to date. Sometimes stuff comes along, and I think it was Fred Rehom who coined the phrase, there's a fine line between folklore and bullshit. Just enjoy the story.
Hey, my grandfather would say, why confuse me with the facts? My mind is made up, you know? It's fiction to begin with, right? And the Hemingway thing. Why let the truth get in the way of a good story? But I appreciate
that. I think that's all folklore.
But history is so important, so it's great to hear these firsthand accounts, and we do know quite a bit about the era and the area.
Sure. And with that said, by the way, I just want to add one tidbit. When Henry landed here at the end of his life, which is what your question was, we believe sentimentally he felt like this was home more than anywhere. Now, certainly he had his River Rouge digs, his Dearborn digs, where his family had their farm, and he grew up and left. But there was a spirit here that made him feel at home. And we believe, and again, without factual account, that he built this colossal power plant across the street so he could pay homage to his lifetime mentor, Thomas Edison, before he left this earth. Mm-hmm. And that's why we dedicate the second story to Henry's career and his Northern Michigan operations. And if you recall the tour, there is a lot of Tom Edison influence.
And there is. But, you know, again, like it seems like every room had its own story to tell almost. It really did. Like the music room downstairs and showing us around. I was fascinated as we kind of made our way into the older parts of the building. What blew me away was the what era is the vintage kitchen that you have preserved in the back you're thinking of restoring?
That's 46. I mean, Henry built the dining room and the kitchen. So that's 43 to 47 while he was here. But I was told recently, I.B. Hutchinson bought this place after the Fords left. I mean, there was one year where a hotel company came in from Marquette. The name escapes me. They kept it for one year, never opened it up, and they swapped out a lot of 40s standard furniture for all the good Ford leather mission stuff.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, we still have some, but not like it was dialed in by him. Anyhow, I forget where I'm going with this.
The kitchen. We were talking about the kitchen.
The kitchen. Yeah. Thank you.
Yeah.
So I'm told by the three daughters of I.B. Hutchinson, who owned this place after Ford's, that their dad loved cooking, and he purchased those appliances. So we're up in the air on that. And what you're talking about are original Magic Chef appliances. They're some of the first 400 ever made.
It's just so
cool.
The
commercial. Yeah, it really is. And they're all nestled in there with underneath the 18-foot cooking line. And I've got to get this information from the ladies. They were kids then, and there's a debate on their part. I believe those were purchased by Henry Ford, but the jury's still out on that one.
Hey, I like when people don't just, make up the facts. That's great. We want to get to the bottom of history. It's very important. So
It really is.
And then we went down into the basement, and you got plans. You got plans going on down there, which is another capsule, another era.
Yeah, and what happened there, we call that private below street recreation. And we have taken the area, and by the way, it's 45 by 125. You can do the math on square footage. We've dedicated 3/4 of the basement to, again, what I call below street recreation for private events and guests. But once upon a time in 1913, there were two bowling alleys there. And they were lost in the late 60s in a flood. Probably Tommy Abbott was party to that. I remember a couple of stories. He's 90 now. He's still hanging around Big Bay. But instead of putting bowling alleys back, which would be quaint, and by the way, I think they were used just to allow certain private getaways, if you will. Most of the loggers back in the day were hardworking, tough, rough and tough. And I think this was a nice little retreat. And again, I'm only surmising, but they had two bowling alleys. We have purchased bowling alley sections from Chicago area, and we've repurposed them into two 16-foot shuffleboard tables, a 34-foot bar, a high-top gathering area. We have Randy's Grand Slam Bar, which is from Koski Corners. That's where 41 and 29 intersect. That would be west of Marquette, and then 29 heads down Iron Mountain. That we're repurposing into a mini bourbon bar. And then in the old coal room, we're having a little gathering area there. And then we have two Brunswick pool tables, vintage 1910 and 1917. So again, for venues like weddings and retreats and so forth, it adds a little 3,000 square feet area where and the ambiance is speakeasy. It's screaming speakeasy down there, and there's three ingresses, so we'll be able to accommodate private accommodations only, which is going to add to that whole ambiance you speak of.
Yeah, and you got to have bowling alleys. It's a Brunswick, you know, former Brunswick company store. You got to have bowling alleys there. And it's great that you acquired those two vintage billiard tables.
Oh yeah, and they are beautiful. One is I saw pictures of a couple pool tables here back in, you know, 1915, and one is exactly the same as that. I got it in Wisconsin. And the other one is a Monarch. That's a classic model of Brunswick. We had to rebuild the legs, but it was given to us for that purpose. And, you know, it's going to take a couple more years to get everything integrated. But the idea is, and you know this when you come to Big Bay, there's certainly a ton of wilderness activity to do. And the cuisine is good. To be able to visit the Lumberjack Tavern where the murder happened and where the film was made based on Volker's book. It's exciting, but we're trying to build an organized destination so when people come here, they've got a full array of activities that they can partake in.
Well, that's just it. You know, I always just associate it with Anatomy of a Murder, and the history that goes on prior to that is equally as rich, and if you know, obviously even more so. Leading up to Anatomy of a Murder, you were obviously aware when you purchased the inn that was the site of they filmed part of the movie there. That was your bar built as, because in real life it happened at the Lumberjack, but in the movie I believe it takes place in your facility. So they built that bar facility for the movie.
Yeah, so I can give you a quick rundown. John Volker grew up in Ishpeming. His father owned a bar. His mother hated it because of the shenanigans that occur in bars occasionally, probably back then more so.
This is ironic, right?
And yeah, and so she tried to keep him away from there, but I believe that's where he cut his teeth on being streetwise and practical, for lack of better expression. So long story short, he ended up in U of M, got a degree in law, came up here, practiced for 12 years as a prosecuting attorney in Marquette. He got beat by 30 or 40 votes in an election, and he had to practice law. So one of his first cases was of Lieutenant Peterson.
Yeah.
Lieutenant Peterson was a non-commissioned Army officer from Wisconsin that was summoned to Big Bay to train Army men anti-aircraft out of the lighthouse. And because he was non-commissioned, he got to stay in a swanky little trailer down at the local park, a couple hundred yards from the Lumberjack. So while he trained 16 hours a day, his wife must have gotten bored in this remote area.
Had a little free time on her hands there.
Yeah, so she'd mosey up and play some pinball. This is all documented really well. So something occurred to provoke Lieutenant Peterson to go in and shoot point blank retired state policeman Mike Shenowitz. So long story short, Mr. Volker defended him successfully with the plea of temporary insanity.
Which was, it was an obscure, wasn't it? Like, didn't it date back to like 1863? It was like some obscure precedent setting case that had
State versus Durfee. You're astute. You study well. Yes, it was the state versus Mr. Durfee. And so there was a precedence, but I think more importantly, Volker being the guy he was, he only lost two cases as prosecuting attorney, and the nuance in the movie, and I don't want to get ahead of ourselves, doesn't really come out well with him going against the prosecutor that actually beat him in an election, and a young, naive, new young prosecutor. So that probably played a big part in that role. Anyhow, so Volcker successfully defended him, and then he wrote the book, Anatomy of Murder, but as the actual attorney, he was compelled not to disclose, meaning he could face being disbarred if he shared client attorney information, right?
Yeah, there was a little bit of backlash going on with the family of the deceased, I believe, at that time.
Yeah, I'm not familiar with that, but I can tell you his book included Big Bay Becoming Thunder Bay and the Lumberjack Tavern becoming the hotel bar. And, of course, he used his mom's maiden name, Trevor, as the pen name.
Oh, was that his mom's name? That's his pen name? Was Trevor? That was his mom's maiden name?
Yes. And he used that in all of his books after that.
Yeah.
But he was appointed to the Michigan Supreme Court, and then that book went viral in beginning of 58. And Preminger, who was also an attorney, happened to see that and offer him consulting fees, movie rights, and an excuse to get back to the UP, because one thing Volcker loved was writing, bourbon, trout fishing, and law. Mm-hmm. So this was his mecca, if you will. And so he retired there shortly after and came up and did become famous. As a matter of fact, if you recall in your tour, his partner desk was given to him as a gift.
That's
from
from
the Supreme Court.
Yeah,
and that resides in our lobby. It's pretty cool.
Spectacular desk. And he was appointed to the Supreme Court by Soapy Menon.
That's correct. And they must have recognized his, I don't know what the criteria is to be, maybe it was his case success, not really sure. But there were a lot of great folks that came up through the hardworking culture that we referred to earlier and went on to do great things in the world, you know?
Mm-hmm.
Hard work spurns success, like Tommy Izzo, right?
Yeah, exactly.
Steve Marucci, I can think of a bunch. That's why the restaurant today was created. It was a Hollywood set, exterior only, dirt floors at the time, bare stud walls, and it was owned by Mr. Hutchinson, I.B. Hutchinson. In fact, he's in one of the scenes when Jimmy Stewart walks through the lobby. Him and his wife are in one of the scenes. It's pretty cool.
What year was the film? What year was the film made?
1959.
59. Yeah.
And I got to tell you, which is interesting to me, Preminger was trained by the greatest cinematographers in the world. And I don't know how they approach him. He must have dabbled in law and cinema. But while he was in law school, they said, would you like to come and train under us? They were the German, Ukrainian, and Russian cinematographers. And at that time, light and sound were in their early stages of development. And he asked his father if he promised to finish his law degree, could he go and study, and he allowed him. He finished, he completed his degree or his law license. And when he came here, Hollywood really coveted the knowledge. And I didn't realize that I thought he came over here and developed his ability, but actually he was trained by the greatest. So it stands to reason, and we have that picture downstairs of 58-year-old Walt Disney literally designing the restaurant in a rendering for the movie set, which is pretty intriguing as well.
Yeah.
Yeah. So by the way, when Preminger got here in Marquette County to see what scenes he was going to film, just like Ford, just like Brunswick, he was so enamored with the working culture that he decided to write an addendum that the actors agreed in their contract to stay from the beginning to the end. It was a duration of 6 to 8 weeks, complete filming of the movie, and made them sign that. So that was a first for Hollywood, by the way.
Yeah, it was unheard of for them to film on location, especially some places remote as northern Michigan. It was just,
And that Lola Turner, she was casted as Lieutenant Peterson's wife, and she had two costume designers. And she told Preminger that they would be designing her costumes, and he said, "Lady, you are in the UP. You will dress like the ladies in the UP, and we'll tell you what that is." And she threatened to tear the contract up, and he said, "Don't bother. I'll tear it up for you." And that's when they casted Lee Remick.
Oh, okay. That's old Remick.
Young, beautiful star. So it was very fascinating, just that story in itself. And again, that's the analogy. When you combine Brunswick, Ford, and Preminger, it's like a bottle of scotch, a 150-year-old bottle of scotch. And most importantly, because it just has to occur, most importantly, what did I want to say about that? I'm losing my track. I know you can record this.
Yeah.
I mean, edit it. I know. So a really, really important point that we like to make both in our written text descriptions and what I'm reciting to you is that we don't use these three great guys, Ford and Preminger, to name drop and say, "Hey, man, these guys are here. Isn't that cool?" We recognize the mobility these guys had. And at the end of the day, when they chose to be here and indulge here in North Marquette County, it just validates the value, the pristine wilderness, the clean air and water, and the working culture. And you'll hear me say that working culture over and over and over, because it's something that seems like we're losing as we evolve into this electronic world. Maybe not, but it certainly drove them, and we use that to validate the richness up here, if you will.
Thank you for listening to this episode of Tales of Northern Michigan's Past with Christopher Struble. Tune in next time as Chris continues his conversation with Mark and Sue Bevins and the Thunder Bay Inn.